This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
It's the Fri-Yay Cocktail, presented by Anna Glavinsky.
We're going to be talking about Paul Weller now, so any Paul Weller fans, make sure you have your ears peeled. I'm being joined by Dan Jennings, who's written a book called Paul Weller, Dancing Through the Fire, The Authorised Oral History. Good afternoon, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm very well, Anna. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, great to have you. Now, you know, what's really caught my interest is the book is an oral history. What really do you mean by that? And how does it differ from, you know, just a biography?
So it's really, if you were to imagine a lot of people, over 250 of them in the pub, chatting about their favourite musician or chatting about a man that they've worked with or lived with, because they're friends and family in this book as well. And they're all building on each other's stories. So it's like a massive play. It's a chorus of voices is essentially what it is. So it's Paul's story told through, you know, his words, because he's in the books loads, but you've also got, you know, his mum, his sister, his friends, his bandmates and whatever. And there's all little snippets, if you like, of them talking almost as if they're talking with each other and building on those stories, sometimes contradicting each other, but taking us right through from the moment that Anne Weller, Paul's mum, met John Weller and fell in love and had Paul, and then takes us through right to the modern day where we're up to Paul Weller's latest covers album.
So it's chronological then, you know, it's following the story of his life. How did you, you know, keep any sense in the chaos of speaking to all of these people and actually keep it to have a timeline or any sort of order whatsoever?
That was the biggest challenge, actually. It's a great question. Because what I had done, so the background of it was that it started out as a podcast and I interviewed people for a podcast. Mm. It was called Desperately Seeking Paul. So it's me and my search to find Paul Weller and be able to interview Paul Weller, which after 180 episodes happened, incredibly, a 2-hour interview with Paul Weller. But in the meantime, I'd interviewed everybody who'd ever known him pretty much. And at the end of it, he said, you need to turn into a book because you've spoken to everybody. And then I did another 70 interviews. And then I transcribed them and I put all the relevant little bits in the right place. And what I ended up with was a book that was 1.5 million words long. Now, bearing in mind, the book that's come out this week is 250,000. So you can understand how overwritten it was. And then it was basically a job of just cutting, edit, to make it try and make sense as a story, because that's what you've got to do, really. You know, it's a narrative. But yeah, that was a massive challenge and a lot of evenings and weekends, to answer your question.
So you came at this, like, so you say, from the point of view of sort of doing a podcast. How did you get access to so many people that knew Paul and then ultimately Paul himself? I mean, it's an amazing coup.
Yeah, I thought it would initially just be me and a couple of fans kind of chatting, because it created it in lockdown. It started when we all had that pandemic and we couldn't go out. So I didn't have much to do, you know. And it's amazing now, modern technology. You can just jump into kind of Instagram and Facebook and whatever, and message people. And ridiculously, people would come back, which I guess is back to that love of Paul Weller in a sense and that kind of loyalty to him, I guess. But nobody was getting paid for it, you know what I mean? They were spending hours with me chatting. And it just kind of built, really. Paul's sister came on episode 12, Nikki Weller, who's done so much. She used to run the Jam fan clubs and obviously, you know, has been throughout the whole thing. So it kind of got that endorsement almost from day one in a way. And it just kind of exploded. It went worldwide. It was bonkers. And the more people that spoke about it on social media, the more people were coming to me and asking if they could do it and things like that. So it became actually very easy to get people on. The challenge was obviously trying to get to Weller. That was always the kind of aim. But yeah, that happened, which is crazy.
And do you know if he was like tuning in? That must have been weird if he was like tuning in to listen to people week after week discussing him and his life.
I was thinking this. I mean, if there was a podcast about you, you'd listen to it every week, wouldn't you? Surely I would. I don't know. I think I might. I think my ego is probably that big. Maybe I would. I don't know.
I think, but then, people, you know, we're not like hugely famous international megastars who are probably just like, well, of course everyone's talking about me. Like, I'm great.
Yeah, but he's not lost in showbiz like that. But I do feel like it got to the point where people were, A, getting angry at him, because it was called Desperately Seeking Paul. People were going up to him going, why have you not done Dan's podcast yet? Get on with it. Or every time he went out, there was a cabbie called Ricky, and he said every time Paul came in his cab, he was saying about the amount of people who kept going on about it to him. So I do feel a bit guilty about that. But yeah, it was, yeah, he had heard about it a lot very early on. Yeah,
yeah, job done. I mean, it really is. That's an amazing story. And then talking about, you know, the content itself and Paul himself as well. What, I mean, you're mentioning friends and family there, all these people around him and knew him. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just getting an impression that perhaps, is he still like quite a grounded person? Is he still surrounded by the you know, the people closest to him and most important to him? And you know,
yeah, there's a lot of people who actually, there's a school friend called Roger Pilling who was mates with Paul when he was, what, 14, 15, who's in the book, and they're still really good mates now. His mate Tufty is really good friends with. They were, you know, mates in, you know, when they were like 18, 19. Steve Brooks, one of the original members of The Jam. You know, he does keep a lot of those. I mean, there are people he famously has fallen out with who he doesn't, but there are a lot of that. But also to say about that grounding, so much of what comes through in the book is that kind of initial upbringing in Woking and the working class thing and that kind of nature of work ethic. And you can see that in his music, because he's always creating, he's so prolific. And that comes through, that kind of story arc, or that's kind of the core of the whole kind of story. And you can see that's still the same. Those values, those core values, are exactly how he runs Weller HQ now, as he did back when he was running with the family at the very beginning, you know.
Yeah, and he's running it, you know, as a business, but he's a musician, a hugely successful one. Let's talk a little bit about his music. I was just saying just a few minutes before you popped on that I was a massive Paul Weller fan when I was like a teenager, and then for some reason just sort of forgot.
Oh. So which period would that have been? What would that have been like?
Sorry?
2010, that would have been, wouldn't it? When would this have been?
Thank you. Yeah, you can come on the radio anytime you like. This is great. No, but I just say, like, I think it's kind of impossible not to have heard of him, not to have heard his music. There must be something that he's written that pretty much everybody must like, whether you're still staying a hardcore fan, which I say, like, I didn't. I kind of forgot. I'm really excited to kind of go back and tap back in, because I do remember just enjoying listening to his music so much. CD time, back when CDs on repeat. What is it about his music that you think just made him so successful? Was it he had a number one album, or had number one every decade?
Yeah, number one album in five consecutive decades, which is not, I mean, there are very few people who've done that. I think Bowie might have done, certainly Lennon and McCartney, but not many people at all. And the most recent one is 2021. That was his last number one album. So, yeah, it's that kind of longevity. I guess, to answer your question, I think there are pockets where people like love moments. So there are a lot of fans who love The Jam and like anything he's done since, and that's fine. I mean, gosh, what a thing to love. Style Council, similar, that kind of 90s period of Stanley Road, where he had his biggest selling album of all time, over 1.2 million, and songs like You Do Something to Me and those types of songs that really kind of were part of everybody's, you know, car stereo and CD collection or whatever. But the thing about the book as well is that thing, I think, ideally you're a Paul Weller fan, but I guess what I wanted to do was, it's not just a book for super fans. You know, you don't have to know everything about every single song. It's not a quiz book to test you on, you know, lyrics and chart position. And it's not one of those books where, you know, sometimes you get a really big book and the text is so tiny that you need a magnifying glass or whatever. It's like, I wanted to make it a really good story. And the great thing about Weller is it's an amazing story from that kind of working class roots to creating The Jam to being top of the pops and having number one singles and albums and songs that went straight into the top of the charts, and then him splitting it at the height of their success, he calls it a day. Then he creates the Style Council, this really silly fun band that also created great songs with political lyrics, these silly videos. That album, the final album of the Style Council, gets rejected. He's all washed up. He's 35. The record industry think he's done and he's never going to come back. And then he has a massive success with Stanley Road. And now, what, 30 plus years of a solo career. So it's this kind of amazing story arc and all these stories. And there's a lot of funny stories in it. I mean, there's some brilliant stories of Paul out on the lash with the band, or being, you know, taking journalists on a pub crawl or to the kebab house and all these kind of things. There's some very, very funny tales in it from some brilliant storytellers themselves, you know.
Well, I'm going to maybe try and see if I can get you to tell us like one of those stories in a minute, just in your own way. But I am interested in sort of what is Paul's take on his own music, why he creates, how he creates, you know, how he's kept it going for all this time, in his own words or from his own point of view.
He talks about it, and this is funny, he talks about it being, I mean, it's a love, obviously, and he's an artist, let's not forget that, but he talks about it being a job, and he can't understand two things. One is artists who take so long to create anything. So somebody like Adele, for instance, you know, and it's like 7 years between albums, he can't work out. And that happens with a lot of new bands as well. It's like a big 5-year gap. He's like, well, what are they doing in the meantime? You know, isn't it the job description that we're meant to be creating music and going out and touring it? So he can't really get his head around that, was what he talked to me about.
Do you think that's from his working class background? He's like a grafter.
I think maybe it's like, but also he's like, well, you call yourself a singer-songwriter musician. What, you know, you did an album 5 years ago. What are you doing? Are you still that? And it's the same way he talks about it with one of the other contributors, about it's like a painter and decorator or a carpenter. And nobody's kind of going on to them about, like, you know, why are you still creating chairs? You know, he's like, well, that's what I do. I create music. That's what you want me to do. You know, I love it. Enjoy what I do. I make a living through it. And he's got lots of kids and family and whatever, mouths to feed, and a Weller HQ, people in employment. So he's like, yeah, what else am I going to do? You know?
Wow. I love that. There's a really, again, a sort of down to earth way of looking at it. So go on, share us like a little tidbit, like one of the little stories that you particularly enjoyed hearing about or writing about.
I love the growing up stories, right? So when they were in Woking, it was proper like working class family, and the dad would do anything and everything to provide for the family, as would Anne, the mum. So, and there were two things that made me laugh a lot. So somebody talks about the fact that with Paul, it's like, you know, there's obviously this talent as a singer-songwriter, and it's a bit like a swimmer. So when you know the like Olympic swimmers now, often when they were kids, they were good at swimming and the whole family geared around them and they all went to the swimming galas and the sisters and the brothers and everybody had to traipse on to this. It was like Paul with the music, but they followed his passion. So he was into football. So John Weller, the dad, created a Woking football team so that Paul could play football every week. Paul was so bad at football that within about 3-4 weeks, he couldn't even get into his own team. And after a while, his dad was like, this is ridiculous. We're like doing all this stuff every week. We're running the Sunday football club and you're so bad at football, you're not even in the team, which made me laugh. But then the other thing was as well, they would, I guess, again, this is kind of almost like classic working class thing and providing, was that Paul said about the fact that sometimes they'd have a van, sometimes they wouldn't. He didn't know how that works or whatever. Their phone would often be cut off and then it'd be cut on because they had to pay for, you know, buy Paul a new guitar or a new suit for the band or whatever. But there's this wonderful story that he talks about of going into Woking and there being this new housing estate being built. And there being all this turf laid out that's about to be kind of put out in this new housing estate. It's all cut up in little squares. And John Weller, the dad, sees it and he's out with his Paul, and Paul's tiny, he's a little tot, and he loads up the pram with a load of this turf, sits Paul on top of it, wheels it home. And the following morning, when they woke up, the family woke up, they had a brand new garden. The working class way.
And I'd like to ask as well, you've done this project, you're really sort of in the world of Paul Weller, but can you remember what you thought of him as a person or his music as a fan before you started all this? And has any of that changed?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because I think you put people on a bit of a pedestal, these people who are stars, like you say, you know, selling hundreds of records, millions of records, that you think they're something else, like they're kind of otherworldly or godlike in a way. So I think I definitely did have him on a pedestal in that sense. And he's so down to earth. I mean, when I met him, he's so down to earth. And he kind of, you know, when he came in to do the interview, it was his studio, so he's kind of studio home. He was just like, Dan, big bear hug, makes you a cup of tea. I don't know if they're all like that. I can't imagine Elton John doing that, or I don't know. Yeah. So I think that was kind of, I don't know if that was surprising, but certainly that was kind of nice that he's not kind of lost in showbiz. I'm sure there are probably moments in his career where he has been. And actually there are, that comes through in the book occasionally, that it was just these big, big moments of stardom. But Yeah, he just, you know, it's that thing of just understanding that actually we're all the same, really. We're all ordinary. Yes, some people have different talents and stuff like that, but we're all just people, right?
So what you're saying is that you weren't let down by meeting your hero, basically, you know, is, you know, you should, they say you shouldn't meet them, but you're glad you did.
No, I think the good thing was because I'd done all this work to get to that point, I think back to that work ethic thing, he'd seen the hours that I'd put in. So it wasn't that I was coming from it as a journalist of trying to get a scoop or a headline and trying to trip him up. So there was that kind of real trust. And actually his manager said, you know, see how he is, you might get like half an hour, or you might get 45 minutes, you might get an hour if you're lucky. 2 hours later, we were still going, and then we took a break, and then we did another hour talking about the new album. So he was just so generous. And then we've done extra interviews for the book, actually, that weren't the podcast, so there's extra content. So he was just so generous with his time, which was, yeah, really, really lovely, because I'm, you know, he didn't have to do any of that, you know. Yeah. He didn't have to go, this is a nutty fan who'd create a podcast, you know.
That's really special. There is really special. And the reason I asked the question, actually, is because if anyone wasn't listening to your podcast and, you know, they're interested in getting their hands on this book, it's, I guess it's going to be the surprising stuff, the intriguing stuff that is what is going to draw people in to the book. So if you just sort of expand on that a little bit before we wrap up.
Yeah, there's lots of people who have never spoken before, which is really nice. So people like Kenny Wheeler, who used to be initially he was hired because he was the muscle. By muscle, he was just big. And he was the bouncer. He was the kind of security guard. And then he then became the tour manager. So Paul has this amazing loyalty. He's still the tour manager now. We're talking about like 50 years. So there's stories from him of talking about the fans hiding in cupboards at hotels. And there's a TV show in the UK called Tiswas, where they used to gunge the band and things like that. And there were just like 3,000 fans that turned up and were running down the street after the bus. So this kind of Beatles mania level of nonsense. But yeah, lots of people who've never told their stories. The fact that one of Paul's biggest songs, Down at the Tube Station at Midnight by The Jam, famous song, everybody loves that song, was a song that Paul said he had a hissy fit, was how he described it. He scrunched up the lyrics, couldn't get it right, and he threw them in the bin. And Vic Coppersmith Heaven, who again hasn't really ever told his story, was the engineer in the studio. He rescued them out of the bin, and that then, rest is history, really, became obviously a massive song that everybody loves. But yeah, there's all these little tidbits of information where you go, well, I didn't know that, or I've heard the story in a different angle, and that's not true. One other final one quickly is Paul was born and named John William Weller. And I often see this whenever anybody in press mentions it, it's like, born John William Weller, and you call his Wikipedia. Anne Weller told me the real story. Even Rick Buckler, who was in The Jam, the drummer who passed away recently, sadly, thought that Paul changed his name to Paul because he loved Paul McCartney. That's not true at all. So the truth of that came through in the book as well, which is lovely.
Oh, I love the way that you just like left us on a cliffhanger there. Very well done. Very well done. Fantastic. Look, I would like you to pick out the next song that I'm going to play. Obviously, you want to buy him, but just tell us why, which song you'd like and why.
Am I picking anything? Okay.
Well, you know, one of the Paul Weller ones, whether it's a jam, style, counter, so whatever, but Adele here.
Let me pick, I'll tell you what, let's pick Shouts to the Top. Is that all right? By the Style Council.
Of course.
I'll tell you why, because it's a song that he still does live now. And he talks about, you know, there was that period where obviously they couldn't gig, you know, none of us could go to concerts. And we love live music. We miss that. He talks about this period where he was kind of, and he created another album. That's what he did. But he did talk about missing live music. And one of the songs he really missed playing was Shouts to the Top, because it just gets, I don't know if you've seen him live, but he just gets such an amazing reaction when he starts playing it, because there's this little intro and everybody realizes it's that song. And you all get really, really excited. And you're all singing back to him and he's singing it. And it's just an amazing atmosphere. So it's great live, but it's just a perfect piece of pop music, which actually, a lot of people think of Paul Weller and they think of those kind of political lyrics and the angry young man and, you know, changing man and all that kind of stuff. You don't always think of actually this kind of 80s pop stuff that's just the best records ever. So yeah, that's a great song.
Just really enjoyable to listen to. Well, Dan, actually, you've been very enjoyable to listen to as well. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. Cheers for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye. The book is called Paul Weller, Dancing Through the Fire, The Authorised Oral History. And if you'd like to get your hands on it, you can find it on Amazon or the Talk Radio Europe bookshop. And here is Shout to the Top by The Style Council.
as the rain came down, I dropped to my knees and I prayed. I said, oh heavenly thing, please cleanse my soul. I see all I'm offering, I'm not impressed at all. Ooh, I was halfway home, I was half insane, and every shop window I looked in just looked the same. I said, now send me a sign to save my life, 'cause at this moment in time there's nothing certain in these days of mine. It's a funny thing when it burns up on you, but I know as much as the day I was born. Though I was an asked, my eyes will stay and promise myself each and every day. The knocks on your back and your life's up. Down on the bottom, there's nothing else but to shout to the top. Whoa, we're gonna shout to the top. We're gonna shout to the top. We're gonna shout to the top, shout. 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 Ooh, we're gonna shout to the top, shout. So when your knocks on your back and your life's a buck, and when you're down on the bottom, you shout to the top, shout to the top, shout. Shout on the bottom, the shout.